Good evening. The United States ends Hong Kong's preferred trade status. Trump backs off on another threat to deport international students. And a child is killed in a hail of bullets in Brooklyn. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Tuesday, July 14th, 2020. President Donald Trump at this hour has ended the special relationship between the United States and Hong Kong.
Today I signed legislation and an executive order to hold China accountable for its oppressive actions against the people of Hong Kong. The Hong Kong Autonomy Act, which I signed this afternoon, passed unanimously through Congress. This law gives my administration powerful new tools to hold responsible the individuals and the entities involved in extinguishing Hong Kong's freedom. We've all watched what happened. Not a good situation. Their freedom's been taken away, their rights have been taken away, and with it goes Hong Kong, in my opinion, because it will no longer be able to compete with free markets. A lot of people will be leaving Hong Kong, I suspect. And we're going to do a lot more business because of it, because we just lost one competitor. It's the way it is. We lost a very, very serious competitor, a competitor that we incentivized to take a lot of business and do well. And we gave them a lot of business by doing what we did. We gave them things that nobody else had the right to do, and that gave them a big edge over other markets. And because of that edge, they've done really historic business, tremendous business, far bigger than anybody would have thought years ago when we did this gift. It was really a gift to freedom. Today, I also signed an executive order ending U.S. preferential treatment for Hong Kong. Hong Kong will now be treated the same as mainland China. No special privileges, no special economic treatment, and no export of sensitive technologies.
And in a news conference at the White House, sounding more like a campaign speech, Trump skewered the Obama administration and his main foe, former Vice President Joe Biden, as being weak on China. China has been enforcing a deeply unpopular internal security law against Hong Kong. The United Kingdom, the former colonial governor of the island, has offered asylum to millions from the island state. And the Trump administration abandoned its plan to strip visas from international students who attend only virtual classes today. The Department of Homeland Security had announced last week that students whose classes were entirely online would have to leave or not be allowed back to continue their studies. The policy was met by a lawsuit from Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The state of New York also announced its own suit against the government earlier today. The agreements reached in the Harvard-MIT case reinstates a policy implemented in March, giving international students flexibility to take all their classes online and remain legally in the country with student visas. The attorney general of at least 18 states, including Massachusetts and California, also sued, charging that the policy was reckless, cruel, and senseless. Judge Allison Burroughs said the agreement applied nationwide. On Tuesday, more than a dozen technology companies, including Google, Facebook, and Twitter, also came out in support of the Harvard-MIT lawsuit, arguing the policy would harm their businesses. New York State Attorney General Letitia James was joined by the provost of the State University of New York and unions representing the college teachers. She says New York State has the second highest number of international students in the country, and deporting them would be financially devastating.
The president's inability to remove politics from public health decisions endanger us all. The diversity of our colleges and university is what makes New York schools around the world most competitive and most sought after. But President Trump's reversal in policy not only threatens these innocent students' educational paths, but our state's hard-hit economy and the public health of millions of New Yorkers, not to mention the intellectual capacity of all of these young students here in the great state of New York. Schools should never have to choose between enrolling students in in-person classes and maintaining public health. And that is why yesterday I filed a lawsuit to immediately halt the Trump administration from moving forward with a reversal of the March waiver, which ignores and runs counter to prevailing public health guidelines. I also recognize that my colleagues in Massachusetts, as well as in California, have filed similar lawsuits. But New York City is home. to the largest number of international students in the nation, threatening more than 100,000 innocent international students in New York, ends up threatening our public health and the health of other college students, faculty, and the health of other college students, faculty, and millions of other residents across New York. Further, the directive would substantially harm schools across our state by forcing them to immediately and haphazardly reconfigure their fall 2020 course offerings in a matter of days, or risk international students' disenrollment. There is no question, implementing ICE's directive will drain and divert New York's limited educational resources, hinder the state's effective administration and enforcement of its own COVID-19 policies, result in millions in lost tuition and revenue for the state's economy, and jeopardize the health and safety of all New Yorkers on and off campuses.
In a statement after Trump's policy on international students was rescinded, Attorney General James said, "Enough is enough. It's time for the president to stop treating immigrants like nothing more than scapegoats and for him to start leading our nation through this national pandemic." She adds, "We will continue to use every legal tool at our disposal to stop him." Meanwhile, the COVID-19 pandemic continues its march across the United States. There were more than 61,000 new cases yesterday, with deaths trending upwards as well. Florida broke all records with more than 15,000 cases on Sunday, beating New York's all-time high set in April. The upsurge came as Disney World led tourists back on its rides, and the Republican National Convention is scheduled to begin in Jacksonville in August. Governor Ron DeSantis has ordered public schools to reopen for 5 days a week when classes resume next month. "If you can do Home Depot, if you can do Walmart," he said, "we absolutely can do the schools." But DeSantis was met by a heckler who accused the Florida governor of doing nothing in the face of the pandemic.
So I think the
every day, and you are doing nothing.
So I think
falsifying information, and you are misleading the public. Over 4,000 people have died, and you are blaming the protesters. You guys have no plan, and you're doing nothing. Shame on you.
The surge in Florida and across the U.S. South and West is being attributed to a younger group than the early days of the pandemic. Then it was seniors who took the brunt. But today, the increase is apparently among young people, mostly in their 20s, who are ignoring social distancing. In Florida and California, that's meant jamming beaches, filling bars, and failing to wear masks. Meanwhile, the rift between President Trump and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the respected researcher who has repeatedly clashed with Trump over the response to the pandemic, grew wider today as Dr. Fauci spoke in an online forum with Georgetown University students. When asked who to trust, Fauci said, "Medical professionals."
For the most part, you can trust respected medical authorities. I believe I'm one of them, so I think you can trust me. But I would stick with respected medical authorities who have a track record of telling the truth, who have a track record of giving information and policy and recommendations based on scientific evidence and good data. If I were to give advice to you and your family and your friends of your family, I would say that's the safest bet to do, to listen to the recommendations from that category of people. But it's entirely understandable how the public can get mixed messages and then get a bit confused about what they should do.
Dr. Fauci went on to deliver a message to youth. It's not about protecting yourself. It's about getting the virus under control.
It's really key to what is going on right now with the resurgences that we're seeing in some of the southern states. And I say this with some trepidation because I don't want to seem preachy about it. But since right now, if you look at what's going on in the country, that the infections are among young people, very likely contributed, at least in part, to what you're seeing on TV of young people gathering at bars, crowded places, congregating, many without masks. There is an understandable situation where a young person could say, you know, statistically, the chances of my getting into trouble by getting infected are much smaller than an elderly person and a person with an underlying condition. And since I, as a young person, am really quite healthy, it doesn't matter to me. I'd rather be there sipping my margarita at a bar in a crowd. Well, to me, that's understandable. I'm not blaming that. That's innocent. However, what they need to understand is that given the nature of this outbreak, even if you get infected and have no symptoms at all and never get sick, you are inadvertently propagating the pandemic. You are part of the problem and not the solution. Because by propagating the pandemic, I mean, it may not matter to you because you probably are not going to get any symptoms. But the chances are you're going to infect someone who then will infect someone who then will be a vulnerable person who could get sick, who could get hospitalized, who could even die. So not only are you propagating the outbreak, but you're actually putting other people in danger. So I would hope you could appeal to the young people to not only take the individual personal responsibility, but think about your societal responsibility. And that's what I mean when I say we're all in this together. Everybody has a place and a role in getting this outbreak under control. And you're not caring whether you get infected or not is not a good way to get the outbreak under control. To get it under control means you don't let yourself get infected and you don't spread to anybody else. And again, I say that with some trepidation because I'm not blaming anyone, and I think people do this innocently. They don't mean to be part of the problem, but inadvertently, they are a part of the problem. And that's the message we've got to get across.
Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. And the result of another lawsuit brought by Attorney General Letitia James was a $1.5 million settlement to 18 workers at Tradeoff, a company that hires poor, often formerly incarcerated women and gives them construction jobs. James says the company has created a toxic workplace for the women of color who work there.
An investigation conducted by my office beginning in October of 2018 found that company managers and employees engaged in severe sexual harassment against female workers, primarily women of color, over the course of at least 3 years. High-ranking company officials not only failed to take appropriate action, but on several occasions retaliated against the workers when they reported the harassment and took other steps to protect managers who were the subjects of the complaint. The harassment included managers demanding sex for pay and overtime opportunities, sexual, physical, and verbal assault by male employees, and sexually explicit videos and photos sent by managers and other workers. These incidents were reported, but Tradeoff managers repeatedly covered up the harassers and even fired several women who came forward. The reality is that throughout the years, Tradeoff has maintained a toxic working environment where employees were routinely mistreated, silenced, ignored, and in some cases, wrongfully terminated. After being made aware of these blatant violations of worker and human rights, my office worked tirelessly with many of the survivors to get the justice they deserved. And I urge all workers to please come forward. This is our first, but this will not be our last. So let this be a lesson to other construction companies and to employers in general who think that they can harass and take advantage of staff. It will not be tolerated. At this time, I'd like to ask Jaleesa McCrimmon, the former employee of Tradeoff, to share a few words.
My first work week started on October 12, 2015, and I quickly found out that things are different for females in this industry. I did not realize how much I had to protect myself from prying eyes, discouraging words, and an unacceptable professional behavior that made me feel that I was not cut out for this industry. and I should be grateful for what I have. I realized this through the arguments, disrespect, and the violation of my rights at the hands of a coworker. I was assaulted at a work site by a coworker. These situations should not happen to anyone. It was time for me to finally speak up the proper way without belittling or disrespecting anyone, but to shine a light on harassment and assault that women in this industry encounter daily. I was not going to be silent about what happened to me, and I felt that it was my duty to speak up and take a stand so that this unfortunate experience did not happen to other women.
Usually from where I come from, you get angry, you get violent. And I didn't want to go that route. And I didn't want to talk to the wrong people. And I didn't want nobody to point me in the wrong direction. It took me months to really tell my story because I wanted to make sure I was talking to the right people, not just for myself, but it was just so many other people that might not have been as strong as me to say something, you know, not as strong enough to just quit the job, because I get that you need to feed your family, and I get that you need to do a lot of things. You need money. Money's not everything, but it's a major thing, and I know that you need it, but to have mental peace is better than anything.
What we're talking about is general laborers on construction sites. These are folks who do heavy, heavy work, lifting heavy material, cleaning, just back-breaking, hard, dangerous work. The first thing that a body shop would do is it's going to trade in vulnerable labor. When we say that, in this case, it was women who had little construction experience and a lot of economic need. The main form of vulnerable labor that they trade in is formerly incarcerated people, people with criminal justice histories. These are people who, under the terms of release under the standard document for parole in New York State, must seek and maintain employment. So if you think about that, what that means is that you need to stay employed or you will lose your freedom. For somebody like myself, if I make a mistake at work, it's upsetting. There's consequences to it, but I am not at risk of being an unfree person. That community of worker, that is what they face, and it makes them incredibly vulnerable. The other feature of a body shop is that it is very low pay. It is remarkable that the average rates for body shop workers are probably on the order of 20% to one-third of what a local 79 laborer makes. This is exploitation. So you take a population of vulnerable people, you make sure of the fact that they are not going to have representation, and you get, to use Ms. James' words, toxicity.
New York State Attorney Letitia James, joined by two women plaintiffs and their lawyer, announcing a settlement in an investigation of Tradeoff, a non-union construction company employing mostly women of color. And in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio reported that the pandemic continues to be apparently under control in the city. All the numbers were down, with some concern over 20-somethings who've been tiring of the lockdown. But the big issue wasn't the coronavirus, but the shootings and killings that struck the city for another weekend. A one-year-old baby in a stroller was killed by a bullet from two men in an SUV who opened fire on a cookout Sunday near Marcus Garvey Boulevard in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Gun violence has been up, although still at historic lows. The senseless killings have struck a chord in the city. De Blasio met the mother of the toddler who was killed. At today's briefing, he had this to say.
The bad news is we continue to have a real problem around this city with shootings this summer. And this is something that very, very sadly we have seen in the past, and we've had to fight back before, and we will fight it back again. But so much pain is being caused, so much fear because of this spate of shootings, and we have to find a way to beat it. And we do that by bringing police and community together in common cause. That's what's always worked. And we got to think of this as human beings. We got to think of this as people, New Yorkers, committed to the same thing. We need safety for our people. We need peace in our communities. Yesterday, I was in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and experienced something so painful. Spending time with the family of Devel Gardner Jr. I talked to his mom, his aunt, his grandma, and just the pain, the grief they were feeling, losing a one-year-old playing on a playground. There, one moment gone, the next, and the shock that they are feeling, and that's just the deep well of pain you could see in their eyes. No parent, no family should ever have to go through that. And if you experience something like that firsthand, I assure you, you could easily fall into despair. But I also want to tell you that I walk the streets of Bed-Stuy with people who are trying to make a difference. Folks from the Cure Violence Movement, folks from SOS Bed-Stuy, an amazing community group that stops violence and conflict before it happens, that mediates disputes, stops retaliation. We talked about what we have to do to end the shootings, particularly what we need to do coming up on this weekend to bring the community out, to occupy the corners, just like we did in Harlem on Saturday night. This is a strategy that works. It's not the end-all, be-all, but it's part of the solution.
Some members of the media asked the mayor if he still supported closing down the anti-crime unit, special cops who were often accused of using brutality in the streets of low-income neighborhoods. De Blasio said he still supports. And he went on to defend his police commissioner, Dermot Shea, who's come under fire for disbanding the unit.
Dermot Shea is one of the people who made this the safest big city in America. And again, if you or anyone else wants to ask the question, absent the recognition that we've gone through the greatest crisis in this city's history and that every aspect of life has been dislocated, families are suffering, people don't have jobs or school to go to, the court system's not working. I mean, come on, we are not dealing with business as usual here. But Dermot Shea is one of the people that made this city safe and helped us find a way through extraordinarily challenging circumstances. He felt, and I agreed with him, that it was important to make a change in our strategy, but to use the talents of our officers in new and better ways. And literally, I don't know anyone who knows more about how to do that than Dermot Shea. So I have faith that we're going to make the adjustments we need to address this problem. The name of the unit is anti-crime. All NYPD officers are involved in anti-crime. That's the nature of the work. And that unit is hundreds of people in a force of 36,000. And the fact is that there are numerous efforts being made to stop violence, including stopping the supply of guns to begin with. And that is something that we work on, the city works on with our federal partners. Everything our detectives do, everything our officers at the precinct level do, everything our neighborhood coordinating officers do to find out the kind of information that helps us with gun seizures. There's so much going on here all the time. And what the commissioner said at the time that he thought that that unit, the way it was constructed, could do its work better with more modern approaches, again, a more strategic approach, greater use of technology, but less disruption to the relationship between police and community. Because it comes back to this again. And I think this is an idea that's still not sort of fully appreciated. The leadership of today's NYPD understands that you cannot create a city that gets safer and safer without full participation of the community. And so if a particular approach is hindering that, you got to find a new approach.
The mayor also addressed reports of low morale among officers and stories indicating many cops are taking early retirement since a $1 billion cut in the NYPD budget last month. De Blasio said it's too early to tell if more officers than usual are jumping ship. But over the weekend, a clash between police supporters and Black Lives protesters in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, indicated public police relations are at an all-time low. The group of police supporters were marching along chanting, when they met the counter-protesters. When a confrontation ensued with a police supporter apparently spitting on a counter-protester.
Spit on you, you suck black the mothers of your white trash.
Later, GOP Assembly member Nicole Malliotakis blamed what she called anti-police rhetoric for the increase in shootings this summer.
Are the cause of this. The anti-police rhetoric we're hearing is the cause of this. And our mayor and our
There were several confrontations as the protests were on through the day and the number of counter-protesters increased. No one was arrested. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, July 14th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.